Hi, welcome. I'm so glad to see all of you here. My name is Diana Rivera. I'm the Chicano Latino Studies librarian here at Michigan State University. And usually when we do these types of things, I come off as the bad guy. But see this? Vibrate. Vibrate or off, it's your choice. But thank you for doing that. On behalf of the libraries, the MSU libraries, I want to thank you all for coming to tonight's event, which is part of the library film series. We are hosting this, but we have co-sponsors here. I don't know if Chicano Latino Studies is here. At the Julian Zamora Research Institute, my print is small, sorry, the Department of Media and Information, Film Studies Program, the Journalism Department, and I just lost it from swiping too far right. But you know, it takes a lot of a lot of collaboration to bring programs together sometimes. And for us at the libraries, we're really, really pleased to be able to work with programs across campus. Professor Hsu brought this to us as a project, and we're just so pleased that she did because it's a very important film. At the libraries, and I also want to thank my partners in this collaboration, Holly Flynn, John Shaw, Mike here from the Digital Media Center, and Teresa Moore. It takes a lot of library staff time, but you know, I think that one of the things that you'll find on campus with our programming is that the libraries is very supportive in making sure that different voices are heard through the resources that we have. I want to introduce Professor Hsu, who will take it from here, and we'll move on with the program.
Thank you, library.
Respond to me.
Go green! Go
that was the first time I ever did that, so yay! We have very special guests here. I chose this film because I think it's an important film. It's a short film, but it's also a film that, I'm supposed to get here, for storytellers, because I'm in the filmmaking program. It's something that's very, I don't want to say this, doable. It's a story that you can find in your backyard. You know people like Innocente. You might not know that you know people, but it's very inspirational, and I think it's a great introduction for people in the film and program and also in the media and information program. Anyway, I know you don't want to hear from me, so what we're going to do is Innocente, who is the character, the main character, I hate calling you that, the star, the subject of the film, will come and introduce the film. And then afterwards, we'll have a Q&A with Susan McLaurie, who's the executive producer of this film, and with Innocente and with me. And then we'll totally open up the floor, and please ask any questions that you want to ask. Right? Totally open. I mean, this screening is really for you guys, you know? And I know a lot of you probably wouldn't have normally seen a film like this, so please ask questions. Anyway, okay, Innocente?
And when you ask questions, please go to the microphones that we have at different points of the room.
Oh, okay, did you hear that? Microphones, you have to go to the microphones just because they're recording this for educational purposes. But don't be shy, it's not a big deal. Okay, Innocente, come up here.
Everybody, how many of you guys have seen this film already? A little bit? Okay, that's good. a lot of you guys will be able to see it. This film took place in, they started filming in 2009, so I was 15 years old in the film, and I am 23 years old now, so a lot has happened. Do not be shy to ask questions. You can ask me whatever you want. I've done many, many of these screenings, so I've been asked just about any question there is out there. No question is too personal, and if you feel like it's too personal, you can ask a friend to ask for you, so don't be shy, and I hope you enjoy the film. And thank you again for coming. It's a great turnout, and we needed extra chairs, so that always makes me so happy. And thank you, Carlene, for making this happen and bringing me and being patient with me, because I'm not the best at replying to emails. So I think she sent me an email, and then I didn't reply for like a long time. But I'm here, and I'm so happy. So thank you, guys. Enjoy.
Second time I've seen this today, and I always get teary. So I want to welcome Susan. Come up here, Susan. She's the one who made it Innocent Day's story possible to reach millions. One of the ones. She's the executive producer. Susan also was nominated for an Academy Award for a film that she did called War Dance, and she does fantastic work and mostly promoting children's causes. And thank you, Susan. It's such a wonderful
film. Thank you for bringing us.
Yeah, it's okay. So anyway, you got Innocent Day, come up here.
Yeah.
Okay, so you guys, I don't know if you want to say something. We're supposed to talk into the microphone, so.
Are they on? Oh, yeah, they are. Yeah. So, yeah, if you guys have any questions, we can start with the questions.
Yeah.
Right?
Hey, Susan, do you want to say something about making the film?
Why don't we just open up to questions?
Okay. Yeah, so the mics.
We're going to do the mics.
Where can we get your artwork?
I have a website, and it's called originalinocenteart.com. And I have an Instagram. Okay. It's at Innocente Art, and there's a link on there. Okay. And I have Facebook also, but I don't remember my Facebook name.
So I'll be purchasing.
There's just so much now you got to keep up with. Yeah. Yes. Don't be shy.
If you can't make it to the mics, just scream out your question, and I will repeat it. Yeah. Oh, do you want to pass? Yeah.
I just want to ask, what does your tattoo represent, and how did it blossom into who you are after the film?
I have a few tattoos. I have a hummingbird right here with a rose, and there's a rose there because in Spanish they call them chuparrosas. Rosas means rose. Hummingbirds don't eat roses, but in Spanish that's what they call them. And I raised a baby hummingbird because my mom found one in an alley, and she gave it to me. And when I was raising it and it started flapping its wings, that's when I realized it was a hummingbird. And then it flew away, and it kept coming back to the place I released it at. So it's very, and supposedly in my mom's beliefs, she believes that if you catch a hummingbird, it's 7 years of good luck. So I'm still waiting for that. No, yeah, these years have been really great to me. And I have a cow with an alien spaceship on my shoulder, abducting the cow. I've never seen an alien, but I believe in aliens, I guess. I've never seen it, so. And my other one, I have a little Devo hat on my ring finger, and Devo is my favorite 80s band. So they do that song, whip it good. Supposedly they're a one-hit wonder, but I like all their songs. So I have the little Devo tattoo, and a lot of my art is actually inspired by Devo, and a lot of my paintings have Devo hats on them, but only people who know that band know. A lot of people say it looks like a flower pot, an upside-down flower pot. That's what it looks like, but it's a Devo hat, and it's supposed to keep all your energy. It's supposed to, your energy supposedly escapes from your head or whatever, and then that hat's supposed to keep it all in there. Yeah.
Thank you.
How much artwork have you made in your life?
I don't really know how many paintings I've done. A lot. Sometimes I don't even know where they are. And sometimes I sell it on my site and I forget to sign it. I'm really bad at that, but I don't know. It's really hard to tell. I feel like hundreds of paintings. Susan has a few of my paintings. And mostly on my website, I sell smaller paintings because they're easier to ship and they're more affordable. And I want people to have my art because I love creating it. So I do smaller pieces. So I do lots and lots of artwork, and I continue doing it.
I have a question. I'm curious about the story behind, like, how... Here. How you come to meet the director, and how you come to say you want to kind of document, record, or share your life through this film? Like how it come to present like this film, this documentary? Yeah, I'm curious.
Yeah, the directors of Innocente were also the directors of our first film, War Dance, and they were working with another producer to make a film called Resilient, which was going to take a look at four women from all around the world who met that description. And they were looking for a young American woman, and they knew Matt DiRigo, who ran Arts, and they asked him if he knew any young women who might really fit that description. And he said, oh, yeah, I do. And so they introduced him, and then Innocente can tell you from there.
Yeah, and I feel like it's really important for all of us to share our stories. So there is documentaries about homelessness, and there is documentaries about homeless youth, but there wasn't... I feel like my definition of homelessness was different. A lot of people, when they think of someone that's homeless, they think of a drug addict or an alcoholic, someone pushing a cart down the street. And homelessness, to me, meant poverty, and it meant not having a stable home and not having a home of your own. So to me, homelessness meant something different. And it's been really great to share my story, because I don't know if you kind of got the vibe from the film, but I felt really alone for a long time. And that's because you don't really talk about it. It's not really talked about. Like, you can go in a room and you can't really point out who's going through something. Like, I can't say, oh, you're homeless. Like, you don't have a place to live. You know, it's not something that you just see and point it out. It's just something that's there. It's there, but you kind of have to start conversations like this, showing the film and sharing it. And I've been sharing this film for a long time, a few years now, and it's been overwhelming because I've never felt more like... what's the opposite of alone? Like, I've met so many people that have gone through this, if not worse. I've met kids who I show the film to, and then they come to me and they'll tell me, oh, I was homeless 2 years ago, but nobody knew, and I'm no longer homeless. And that's the thing. Like, that person was homeless 2 years ago and nobody knew, and now they're not. But it's been really interesting to be able to see all the different people that can connect to this film, and it was really important for me to share kind of my side. And it was really important for my mom to be given the opportunity to where she could share her story, because she was very open, especially because no one had asked her before, like, what's your story? Where did you come from? Like, say something. Like, we were just living in shelters, and, you know, it wasn't like no one really asked her what she thought about. And like you saw in the film, you know, she thought, you know, the United States was paradise, and she explained it. And a lot of times in Mexico, they do explain it differently. They say, if you come to America, they're going to give you a house. They're going to give you a car. They're going to give you a job. And that's not it. The reality is, we came to the United States, and then for the next 9 years, we were homeless. Yes, we love it here. And yes, my mom has a place to live now, but she worked for that, and she suffered a lot to get to that, if that makes sense. So sorry, I go on and on, but yeah, hopefully that answered the question. Who has the mic?
Hi, so where are you living now, and do you still live in San Diego? And isn't there an enormous homeless population in San Diego, like there is in all of California?
Yes, I live in San Diego, and I've been living there my whole life almost. And the homeless population there is actually getting a lot worse. And it's really sad, because I see how the city works it, and the way that they do it is that they're criminalizing the homeless. They're doing lots of sweeps where all the homeless sleep. They go during the day with the big, you know, the big trash cans, the ones that pick up the trash, and they just throw all their stuff in there, and they just throw it. And it sounds like bad, but it's the truth. That's what's going on. And they ticket them for loitering. And then when they ticket them, when they can't pay the ticket, they arrest them. And there's nothing helpful in that. And I feel like more people are complaining in the other cities because they're being pushed away from downtown. The other cities that are just a few miles away are complaining. They're saying, hey, the homeless are, you know, sitting outside my business. They're scaring the people away. But there's no, they're not helping by pushing them away. And I've gone to so many different places, and there's so many different places that do good and do help the homeless. And there's so many places that just don't know how to do it. I went to one place where they put in a law where you can't sit on the sidewalk, and then all the homeless left because it was illegal to sit on the sidewalk. And then they're like, hey, yay, we fixed our homeless issue. And it's like, no, if you go to the next county, that's where they all are because you made it illegal to sit on the sidewalk. So there's so many places that unfortunately do that. And in San Diego, there was only one shelter that I knew of, Toussaint, that housed young adults that were homeless, and that closed down last year. So it just gets worse and worse. And, you know, I'm saying it and it sounds bad, but it's the truth, and that's what's going on. And there's, I don't know if they just don't know how to help. There's just not enough resources. I think the main thing is resources. Like, you can't just offer homeless people like a house, because they don't really know how to deal with that. It's steps, and they need resources, and they need to learn how to write resumes, and they need to learn how to pay bills, and they need to learn how to, you know, kick the addiction, not just house them, but give them resources. So I think in San Diego, it's a huge problem, and I hate seeing it because I lived there for so long. And again, when I was 15, we were living in all these shelters, and, you know, many years later, there's people that are in that same exact situation I was in many of those years ago. There's just families that keep coming in, and a lot of the times they have kids and their kids have kids, and then it just feeds the system because no one tells them, you know, it's, no one educates them, and no one really, I don't know, there's just not enough resources in my opinion. And yeah, it's getting worse, unfortunately, in San Diego. As much as I love it there, I do see the issues getting worse.
Okay, not to get all up like in your business, but, like, after the film, did you get closer to your mom? Like, did that bring your relationship, like, closer? Because you learned, like, a lot about each other?
Actually, no. We still are, we don't like each other. And, you know, I have friends who are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and they still don't get along with their parents. I know that some people just never get that chance. They never get to kind of have that relationship with their parents. And that's okay. Like, I have lots of people who I get support from, and I have lots of parent figures in my life. And I mean, I understand my mom was raised differently. She has a different mentality than I do. She didn't get the same opportunities I did. So I understand why we disagree on a lot of things. But maybe 10 years from now, we'll be better off. You can ask me again 10 years from now. But for now, it's still pretty much the same, if not worse. Like, I don't really get along with her. I see her all the time. I have a little sister who's turning 3 in June. So, and the dad is absent. So there's that too. Not to bash my mom, but that's just, you know, things happen. And even though life does get better, things still are going to happen in life. So, yeah. My brothers are good. So I'm 23. One of my brothers is 22, and he just graduated from a university I don't know, because I don't really get along with him. But I know he's in Canada right now with his girlfriend, and then he's moving back to San Diego. And my little brother, who's 18, turning 18 this month, I'm sure he's watching on there, Uli, he's turning 18. Happy birthday, Uli. He just got accepted into a really good private university in San Diego. So he got accepted at Point Loma Nazareth University, and he's really excited because he was being, he only signed up for one school. Like, he only applied for one school, and he got into that school he wanted. Like, his faith was on point because he got in. And other people applied and they didn't get in. So he's going to go there and he's really excited. And then I have a 15-year-old brother and I actually teach at the high school he's going to. So I'm a teaching artist after school. I teach the kids their art after school. And then the baby, she's turning 3. Yeah, so big family. Yeah.
First of all, I wanted to thank you for sharing your story, including the parts where you talked about the violence in your family, because mm-hmm. That's an issue that's also like personal to me with loved ones that have dealt with that.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could, if you'd be willing to talk about kind of the legacy of that violence, but also how you're telling your story and like especially telling it many times and kind of talking with people, but also your art, how that... maybe like responds to or even like transforms that violence, maybe even for yourself or with other people.
So. Yeah. So, I mean, when I paint, like I said on there, I paint happy things. If I were painting what I was feeling most of the time, then it would just be really dark. And I feel like if I were to paint something sad and then I go look at it, I'm just reminded of the sadness I was feeling. So that's why I don't paint anything sad. And so I paint lots of happy things, even when I'm, like, upset. But as for, I guess, the generations, I mean, I've been, I went to high school with, there's this high school in San Diego that's called the Monarch School. And when I was in eighth grade, I went to that school. So it was all kids that were, their families were homeless or they were living in shelters. And it was really sad to see because now a lot of those kids, they're still struggling because they fell back into the cycle. And it sucks because a lot of them just said, I'm not, we saw our parents and we saw the struggle and we're like, we're not gonna be like our parents. We're gonna get jobs. We're gonna stay in school. Like, we're not gonna like continue the cycle. And a lot of the girls that I was friends with, like they have like 3 kids already and their oldest kid is like 6 years old. And you know, it's, I don't know if there's not enough support for that. Or like, I don't know like if they, I don't know how to explain it, but like, again, like we say that we're going to break the cycle, but ultimately it takes self-control and it ultimately takes us to actually do it instead of just talking about it and saying we're not going to do that. It actually takes us doing it and actually it takes us, you know, setting an example. But like I said, my mom and I don't really get along because we have so many differences. Like she doesn't... she just doesn't understand the opportunities that I got. Like in Mexico, domestic violence was a big issue. And here it's, you know, it's a lot more serious. And when I was younger, I was in this abusive relationship and she didn't really understand how to help me with that. So it was really interesting to see that she really didn't have much reaction to that. And ultimately I said, like, I saw that it happened to her too many times. So I was like, yeah, that's not, I don't want it to continue happening to me. So, yeah, it's been interesting to see how she reacts to the things that happen in my life because she doesn't, like, she just doesn't understand. And it just, it sucks that she doesn't understand. But, yeah, it's hard to see that a lot of the kids that I did know and was friends with unfortunately fell to the same things. A while ago, I went to the mall, and this kid stopped me, and he's all like, hey, do you remember me? And I was like, not really. He's all like, yeah, we were in, like, seventh grade together at Monarch, and I was like, oh, cool. And then he was like, yeah, I don't have a job. Like, I have a girlfriend who had a kid, and he showed me his pot plant. I'm not, like, against it, like, pot, but I don't smoke pot, but he had a pot plant in his backpack, and I'm like, oh. He's like, I grew out of a seed, and I'm like, okay. And it was just interesting to see. It was just a reminder that there needs to be like more support for kids like that. Otherwise, they're just going to end up back in the system. And I mean, he was 23 years old. He was my age. And he was just, he didn't have a job. Like, he was living with his mom again. And he just didn't know what to do. And him and I, like, when we bumped into each other, we talked for like 2 hours because it was just like, I wish I could help him, but I don't know how. So it was just really hard for me to kind of see that, and it was really sad, yeah. But it happens, unfortunately. And again, I'm just talking. Do we have like a time limit? Because I talk a lot.
Okay. First, congratulations on your accomplishments. My question is, when did you stop painting your face?
I think when I was about 18. So here's the thing. When you see a little 15-year-old girl with her eye makeup, you're not going to go up to her and be like, hey, little girl, why you look like that? And then when I became an adult, they're like, why is that adult person looking like that? So I kind of stopped doing it just because I didn't want that confrontation, because I will say like, hey, that's none of your business. And then I'll get in an argument with them. So I rather avoid that. So I don't do that anymore. Plus, girls know makeup is expensive. So I was using way too much eyeliner. And sometimes I would get tan lines from all those designs. So I stopped doing that also because I didn't want more tan lines from my designs. So there's lots of reasons. It takes too long. And I don't know, I just don't do it anymore. I sometimes do it just for fun. And I still see people stare at me. I think, you know, I say in the film, I don't want to grow up, but you can't help it. You just do. Unfortunately, you just do, and it sucks. So I feel more like I don't want that confrontation, so I don't do it anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of a two-part question. Is there anything now that you watch the film over and over, and now that you're older, is there anything that stands out to you that you're like, oh, not embarrassed that you said it, but you're like, oh, I can't believe that I thought that way at that age. And then The second part is, if you could go back and speak to yourself at that time, what advice would you give to yourself?
Stay in school is the only advice, probably, because I dropped out of high school because I was being bullied. So that's the only thing. I don't regret anything that happened. The only thing I regret is that I didn't stay in high school. I wish I would have stayed. I know there was lots of experiences that I missed, and that's the only thing I wish I would have stayed. I think one of the things that I'm so lucky to be able to watch in the film is that a lot of people that I talk to, and I think one of the questions that people ask a lot is, like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Like, where do you want to be? And it's hard to say because, I mean, I don't even know where I was last year. I don't really remember what I was doing too much last year. And I'm very lucky to be able to see my 15-year-old self in film. Like, I don't really remember a lot, but it's there to remind me that all those things did happen and that was me at that age. So I'm really, really lucky to be able to see that and then say, hey, there was a change. Like, here's me, like, 8 years later. So a lot of people don't have the opportunity, and I'm so, so lucky that I'm able to do that and think about it that way. So it's impacted me in that way, where if I ever feel like something is, like, not going right, I get to look at that and say, that was a long time ago, and, like, today will be a long time ago from, like, 5 years later, if that makes sense, you know? So I'm lucky to be able to see that in film. Yeah. And it was very emotional. I don't know if I said this already. We had a screening earlier, but when I saw the film for the first time, it was very emotional because they interviewed my mom separately from me, and I didn't see the film until it was finished. So the stuff that my mom said about the bridge, I didn't know. Like, I don't remember that. I probably blocked it out of my head because that's not something I want to remember. So it was something very emotional for me to watch. And I remember the first time I watched it, I was at the Arizona Film Festival, and it was one of the first film festivals that showed it, and one of the very first festivals I went to, and I remember crying and crying the whole time.
Oh, you're really a gutsy painter. Did you always paint on the very large scale?
No. And the only time I really painted in a large scale was at the art center. When I got my first apartment, the thing is, you give a deposit and you want your deposit back. So I didn't want to mess up the apartment, so I, you know, get paint everywhere, so I wanted my deposit back. So I didn't really get to do much of too many big paintings. And when I do big paintings, they're a lot cleaner. They're not, like, too messy. They're not with my hands. They're messy, but they're messy with a brush, if that makes sense. But yeah, I still have lots of fun creating big pieces.
Hi. So my question is, like, as you reflect onto your 15-year-old self, can you just talk about a little bit the development of your artwork and content and inspiration? And so you say, like, often that, you know, you like to paint happy things and positive things. As you've developed, how has your art developed in correlation to your experiences in content and inspiration?
Yeah. I think it just depends on what's going on in my life. Like, at the moment, that's really what inspires me. I believe it was last year. My goal last year was to go whale watching because I wanted to see a whale. And I painted and painted and painted lots of whales. And it was interesting because I didn't really know what they were like. You know, you see them in videos, but it's another thing to see them in person. So I painted lots of whales and I wasn't getting it right. Then I went and saw whales for the first time and I was so excited and it just completely changed the way I painted whales, if that makes sense. A lot of my paintings, I paint lots of rabbits, and that's because when I got my first apartment at 18, I adopted two rabbits because even though, you know, there's homeless people and there's also homeless animals. So I rescued two rabbits and they're still alive and well. They live up to 15 years. So I'll be like 30 with rabbits. And, that's exciting for me, so I'm not complaining. But I paint lots of rabbits, and like I said, I paint lots of things with Devo hats. And I paint, you know, I've been painting a lot of animals, like elephants and rhinos, because it's unfortunate. I know, I'm sure you guys know that their numbers are decreasing, and it's really sad to just think that one day those animals won't be there, you know, to inspire, like, my art. So I do a lot of paintings of animals. And like I said, all my art is a lot cleaner now, less messy, and I do smaller scale paintings unless I feel really, really inspired and unless I feel like I have to paint big. But most of my paintings are smaller and cleaner. Did that answer the question? Yeah? Okay. Any more questions? Are you guys shy or you guys just don't have questions?
What's your favorite piece that you've painted thus far and why?
I kept it, actually. I painted it, I believe, in when I was 18. And that was before I adopted my bunny, Luna. And it's a painting of my bunny. He's an albino bunny, so he's white with pink eyes. And he's sitting in a Devo hat. He's sitting in a Devo hat, and he has three eyes. And the background is yellow, which is my favorite color. He has three eyes because three is my favorite number. And he's sitting in a Devo hat because Devo is my favorite band. So it's my ultimate favorite painting that I love and will keep forever. Yes.
Awesome.
And even though I have two bunnies, he is the favorite because he doesn't like bite me or anything. Bun Bun is really mean. She just hates me for no reason. Like, I'll you know, kneel down and clean up stuff, and she'll, like, come nip me in the butt and run away. And I didn't do anything. She's fed. She's not hurt. She doesn't need anything. She just doesn't like me, even though I saved her life and I gave her a boyfriend. And I don't know what else do bunnies want. Somebody tell me, because I don't know. But, yeah, they're... Huh? Yeah, I don't know. I wish she could just tell me, what do I need to do to not be... I don't want to be bitten anymore. And, you know, their teeth are, like, really sharp. And she bites only to hurt. Like, she could literally make me bleed, but she doesn't. She just bites to make me hurt. She could break skin, but she doesn't. So she's just really weird like that.
It's funny.
Yeah. And it's really funny because when I was looking for a girlfriend for my Luna, I had three candidates. And, yes, you do bunny dates. So there was bunny dates, and the other two bunnies that I fell in love with, they didn't like him, and he didn't like them, and Bun Bun just instantly fell in love with them, and I regret it for the rest of my life. She's mean.
I wanted to ask, why did you keep the painting that you did from your art show, and do you still have it?
I do not have it. Actually, the filmmakers have it. Sean and Andrea, the directors, the filmmakers have it. And I kept it because it was a family portrait. So it was titled If Only They Could See, because they didn't understand what being an artist was, especially my mom. For a long time, she thought it was, like, really bad, like if I was in a gang or something. Like, she just thought it was something bad because she didn't understand that being an artist was an option. And that's why it was titled that. And I kept it for a while, and then I wanted it to go to a home, a good home, so the filmmakers have it. Yeah. We had a question up here.
Yeah, this is actually for Suzu.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, thank you. So let's say, like, a young filmmaker or someone who wants, like, a young student, they find a really compelling story, like in Ocente. What are some of the first, if they want to go about telling that story, making a documentary, what are some, like, the first steps to get that ball rolling? Do they reach out to a producer? Do they develop the story? Can they, I guess, or at least what's your process in terms of when you find a story, what are some of the first things you do to make that story, like, come to fruition?
You know, it's a really good question. And every film we've done, we've taken a different path. Sometimes filmmakers come to us with stories, and by now we've developed a reputation. We tell stories about kids struggling against serious odds. If you're a young filmmaker, I think, you know, I think Lynn could probably speak to this even more than I could, but just do whatever you can to start shooting and to start conceptualizing it. And you know, I heard Lynn say something earlier today that you don't have to worry about expensive equipment. You know, this is an extraordinary time historically to be a filmmaker. You can shoot so much on your phone. Just do what you can to start to nurture an idea and go from there.
Are you talking about documentary films?
Yes.
Okay. You know, it's really hard. The thing about you guys, and I see a lot of people here, sorry, who want to be filmmakers, you know, it's like you got to be tough. And when you find a story that you find very precious, you have to kind of shape it and mold it and treat it very gently. And so what I would do first, and what I've done in the past, is you just start relationships with the people who you are in the film first, right? That's the most important thing, because you're entering their life, right? And vice versa, they're entering your life. It's going to be like a partnership when you start making a film together. So, you know, that's probably the most important thing, is a relationship with your subject. You know, and if you have not a character, but maybe a theme, right? Themes aren't really stories yet, but it's like you got to make sure that you love that theme and you research it to death and know everything about it. You have to get basically become an absolute expert in that realm. Do you know what I mean? And then you can know how to shape it. And then if there's a character that speaks to that theme, that's the best thing, right? You find a character to tell your story so people can relate to that character. But yeah, I mean, what she said about fancy equipment, and I keep saying this to my students in my class, you don't need a RED. You don't need the super best camera, right? It's what's the most important tool that you have is your mind, right? And your creativity, that's the absolute most important thing. So if you have, like, a decent camera, you know, and you have started a relationship with people, right, you can just start slowly and start shooting a little bit at a time. John, right here, I didn't do this. I do larger HBO films and things like that, and... But John, his very first film, which he started in college, which was a film called Pass It On, you started very small. It was a student film, and it went on to get a national broadcast and go to Cinema du Real and did the entire festival circuit. But it was just like a few people. You know, it was like four crew guys who just had this passion for this subject. And so that's really what you need at first, right? So, I don't know if that answered your question. Probably not. But anyway.
I had a question over here, and then...
Oh, stereo. Did you go to the Academy Awards?
I did get to go to the Academy Awards.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Wear face makeup?
I did not. Someone actually did my makeup. Someone actually did my makeup.
You too, Susan? Did you get your makeup done?
I didn't go.
Oh, no.
No, I didn't go. I was teaching at the time, and I just I couldn't take the week off. And to be honest, I didn't think we were going to win. And so I was so mad when I was sitting with friends and we won. And I said, "Oh damn it! I could have gone to the after party."
I was
so mad at myself. So,
So who did you beat?
I met Daniel Day-Lewis. He was really sweet. I met Daniel Radcliffe. I love Daniel Radcliffe.
My God!
Harry Potter. He's like my height. So.
I know.
He's really short.
That's Harry Potter, you guys.
Yeah, Harry Potter. Was that guy from Aerosmith? Steven Tyler or something?
Steven Tyler.
Yeah, he was nice too. Yeah, we met a few people there. Yeah, it was really interesting to see everybody there because they're just normal people. Yeah, they're just normal people to have some fun there at the party. So it was fun.
Oh, okay. Yeah. There's a question over there.
Yeah. So my question is, you said that there were a lot of, that your definition of homelessness was different. And there's a lot of interpretation when it comes to homelessness or misinterpretation of them being drug addicts or alcoholics. How do you suggest that we go about speaking about homelessness and how to like find solutions and suggestions and just better inform people of like what it is to truly be homeless and the difference between someone that is an alcoholic versus someone who just kind of ended up there?
Well, the main thing that I see and on the many places that I've gone to is the lack of resources. And here's the thing, like, if people don't know that there is something to be offered, then they won't ask for help. Like, it's hard to say, hey, I need this. But it's easier to say, hey, I heard about this when they know that it's there. Does that make sense? Like, it's easier. Yeah, it's just so much easier to ask for help when you know it's actually there. I don't know. It's really hard because in different places, it's different everywhere. But I think starting a conversation is the easiest way to kind of talk about homelessness because everyone experiences homelessness in different ways. Some people live in their car. Some people just are couch surfing. Some people are just staying in a room with so many other people. So everyone has their own definition of homelessness, and it's just starting that conversation. It's just starting to share our stories and not being like embarrassed, not hesitating to say I was homeless or I am homeless. It starts with us. Like I said, only we can change with, like, we have to be determined. Like, they can offer us as many things as possible. Even if they offer us all the resources, it won't help unless you're like determined to kind of change that. So it's just starting a conversation and making people feel like it's a normal thing because it is. It's become normal to be homeless because there are so many people that are homeless. And yeah, just have that conversation with everybody and find places, find resources. And one of the things that I've seen throughout my travels is that there is places out there, but too many people like don't go out to look. Like, there'll be this organization that offers this and this other organization that offers that, but this organization doesn't know that this one's offering this and this one doesn't know that this one's offering this. Does that make sense? Like, if everyone would just come together and say, hey, I can offer your people this, or these people can say, I can offer your people that, like, it would be such an easier place to live in, because I've gone to countless places and I'll be visiting for the first time and I find out about these programs, and then I'll be talking to another program and I'm like, oh, you didn't know about this program that I just went to not that long ago? They're right here, like a few miles away. Like, why don't you know? And I just got here and I know. Why is that the case? Like, and it's because, you know, I think too many times organizations are busy with their own little, you know, with their own organization, and they forget that there is other places out there that offer resources. So again, it's like going out there and seeing what places have to offer, if that makes sense. Because I've seen it countless times and I continue seeing it. There is places that offer things, but people don't know about it.
We can take one or two more questions.
right here, up here.
How long did it take you to make this film?
Well, we came into the process late. As I said, it started off as another film, and the directors had some problems with that producer. They had worked with us before. They asked us to come on. So at the point that we came in, they'd been shooting off and on for 2 years, and then we worked with them for another year to finish the film.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi. My question's essentially, like, it's one thing if somebody's an actor in a movie and they kind of, like, come out into the normal world and, like, talk to people and they can be like, yeah, that's a character, like, that's a thing that I did, like, I'm a different person, whereas, like, you know, in a documentary, that was you, like, that was what was happening that day. And there's less kind of, like, separation between, like, what people see and, like, who you are and what you were going through. I was just wondering if you could, like, talk, like, if that's difficult, if it was weird at first, or you've gotten used to it, like, what is it like, having a bunch of people you've never met in your life, like, see such an intimate kind of thing?
Well, I think I've separated myself a little bit from the film in the sense where it's not just about me, but it's about so many people that are homeless, so many people that are immigrants, so many people that do love the arts and art itself, and they, you know, they struggle because, like I said, I know lots of kids that their parents didn't get those opportunities, so they don't understand how to deal with that. But I've separated myself just a little bit, so it's not, I mean, I don't really stay in and watch the film because I've seen it countless times. Like earlier we screened it in Ling's class and I fell asleep during the screening. I was tired, but I've seen it many times. But it wasn't weird because again, it was a documentary, so I didn't have to do anything that I didn't want to. People only stared at me a little bit more because there was cameras following me. But overall, it was an interesting process. The filmmakers were super nice, and I was 15, so I did have times where I was just extremely, you know, dramatic and upset, and I just didn't want to deal with it, and they understood. And, you know, they were spending money to fly from D.C. to San Diego and money to stay there and money for equipment and money to film. And some days I was like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to film. Like, I'm emotional. I'm crazy emotional right now. Like, leave me alone. And they would, because it was, they understood that. And that, I think, adds on to your earlier question about how do you, you know, film someone. And it's having, like, you are, you know, it is a personal thing. And it is, you know, they are telling their story. And the first step is, like, having a good relationship with them. And I had a really good relationship with the filmmakers, and they were really sweet. And I didn't want to tell the kids, you know, at my school that we were filming for that reason. So they're very helpful in not letting the kids know what was going on. And they were very respectful of the decisions I was making in my life. And they were very respectful in what was going on at the moment. Was that your question? Or again, I just went, all right, I think we're
done. Do you want to make some wrap-up comments, either Susan or you?
I want to say thank you for everyone who showed up. I'm so happy that we even needed extra chairs today. So that was really sweet that everyone showed up. And I hope you guys talk about this film with your friends. And there's the trailer on YouTube, so you can share the trailer on YouTube. And it's a very important film, because I feel like it's going to be relevant as long as we have homelessness, as long as the arts are being taken away from our schools, as long as immigration's an issue. So this film will be important for generations to come. So please continue sharing it, and thank you guys for having me.
Yeah. Then. I just want to thank Ling for organizing this and for all the departments here at Michigan State who came together to put this today's program together, and you made us feel very welcome. So thank you all.
Thank you.